Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
There is a peaceful solution called peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Well, it's been a while since you heard about some peaceful solutions from the Peace Revolution, and I'd like to welcome you all back, including those of you listening through the Peace Revolution Mirror feed found at renaissance.libsyn.com. That's what used to be the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast feed. The Liberated Syndication feed, or Libsyn feed, has both the Peace Revolution and 9/11 Synchronicity podcast all in one. But it's not as visually stimulating as the Podomatic page, so we're two streams of consciousness meeting simultaneously through Peace Revolution. I'd like to thank TragedyandHope.com for making this podcast commercial and advertising free, as well as Gnostic Media, Corbett Report, Maria.net, Media Monarchy, and the School Sucks podcast. So let's start with a summary of the media we're about to consume. It's something unique and revealing, and of course, to do so, it has to be a bit unconventional in the process. What you're about to hear is a recreation of the scenario I experienced a few days ago, and I wanted to share it with you, and it went something like this. Back on December 10th, 2009, Paul Verge was here, and we were shooting some footage for his upcoming film, Believers Beware, which Paul's been editing since then. So earlier this week was the first time I got to review the footage. Paul had edited the raw footage and organized the clips with about 15 seconds of notes before each clip. Pertaining to what's in the clip and watching the 2.5 hours of footage, I thought, wow, there's about 104 quality sound bites pertaining to the underground history of our education system and the world in general. And I wanted to share the audio with you because I think you're really going to be able to get the big picture if you're patient and listen. So I've provided you with Paul's notes found in the podcast notes of this episode,
and I've decreased the time between sound bites from 15 seconds 5 seconds for your convenience.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Last but not least, we've got a lot we want to do, and part of that is the production of not only this podcast, but a new video variety show called What You've Been Missing, which I've written a pilot and outlined the first 8 episodes. WYBM, What You've Been Missing, will be a set of standalone episodes which individually provide a comprehensive perspective focusing on one topic of concern. But in unison, all of the episodes will provide the starting points of a comprehensive education, which will support our Comprehensive Conscious Curriculum, or C-Cubed, project. All of these projects focus on helping you better understand the world we live in and how you can more successfully pursue and attain happiness. I created Tragedy and Hope in the Peace Revolution podcast as the ultimate resources which you could use to unlock your own potential by learning how to learn for yourself, to use your curiosity to ask questions and seek and find relevant and meaningful answers. That's the primary axis around which all of my work is based. I don't have to believe in your potential. I know it exists. Maybe better than some of you do, because I've seen what the intellectual elite are willing to do to subvert your potential. And my only belief is that once you realize your potential for what it is, that you will use it to pursue your own happiness and embrace the tools that we've struggled so hard to provide you with. And we will continue to provide you with an ever-increasing level of valuable components over the next several months of production and publication. It's at this point that I need to ask for your help in keeping this podcast going, because if you appreciate the content we publish, please use the PayPal buttons on peacerevolution.org or tragedyandhope.com and either subscribe to support us monthly or make a one-time donation. And even if it's just $1, it shows us that you're there, you're listening, and that most of all, you care. Because this is all about empowering your curiosity. Your true teacher is your curiosity. and the Peace Revolution podcast is simply designed to help you discover and develop your potential. I hope that you enjoy this journey through the raw footage. Be sure to reference the notes that I've posted to help ensure that you don't get lost along the way. This is more of a appetizer. This is episode 6, The Intellectual Elite versus You, The Resurrection of Critical Thinking. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out. Enjoy. Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you think back to our education, I don't remember being taught anything about a new world order. Think that the famous quotes by George H.W. Bush on September 11th, 1991, and the subsequent quote by Gary Hart. It was Gary Hart who had also talked about the new world order, I guess brought it into the public conscience. And then it was looking into books from the past and seeing that this is not a new idea, that this idea started with Plato's Republic. And I have several different versions of Plato's Republic by various authors and whatnot, but the point would be they're kind of hard to understand. It's heavy language. So I thought to explain this idea of the New World Order, I'd break out some spark notes, which are cliff notes type thing. And the idea of the New World Order has been around since, let's say, Plato's time. So that's 400 BC. So this isn't a new idea. It's an idea that has existed since somebody got more information than somebody else, and they sought to use it against somebody else. So it's not a new dynamic. It's the use of intelligence and it's the use of the intellect to subvert other people's conscience. And so when you look at all of these things that we'll talk about through this interview, these are all like leaves on a tree, because the tree's root and the tree's core, the tree's trunk, if you will, has to do with the suppression of consciousness. And so when you're talking about the idea of a new world order, this is the idea of suppression of consciousness, just not of a small group, but the idea of doing it around the world. You know, it's a comprehensive endeavor where a certain group of people, a certain strata of the intellectual elite, seek to subjugate those masses who were denied a proper education.
Okay.
Well, when you look at the history of these ideas and you see them bubbling up through Plato's Republic, and you might say, well, that's 2,500 years ago. What about today? Well, in the last century, you had a book by H.G. Wells called The New World Order. And so these ideas, which are old and ancient ideas, have been brought up today, and certain people in the last century have coveted these ideas and taken less than public routes of getting these ideas into everybody's consciousness, even if it's subliminally or, you know, as an aside, out of context, like George H.W. Bush's comments in 1991. That wasn't the point of the speech. That's just one little line in the speech, but it has resonance today, because when you look at the history and how it's repeated, and how it's repeated through the works of H.G. Wells and other Fabian socialists and other theosophists of the early 20th century, it's obvious that these ideas were coveted for reasons. The reasons are that they give people power, and that people who use greed to attain power are inclined to practice these ideas, to keep them alive, to formulate countries based on these ideas, such as America was formed. The Agatha Christie story has a lot of parallels, not only to things that have happened in the last 20th century, but it's basically giving you the blueprint of how these types of power struggles have been carried on and how they are illustrated through our history. And the idea, not to be a spoiler for those of you who haven't seen the movie, but the idea is there's a murder and there's too much evidence. And there's so much evidence that the inspector says it can't just be one person. So he was suspecting, you know, this person or this person. There was one little thing that lets you know that it wasn't just one party, right? And so each party had a little alibi or a plausible denial. In actuality, what you have is that each party plays a specific part, and each part involves an actionable part and a part of plausible denial. And so when all these parties act in concert and commit a crime, when the inspector comes in, they're expecting to find one person or one group. In actuality, how it's practiced is all these groups are specialized, interchangeable parts.
and they all have a specialized and highly unique role, and they work in concert to create effects that are greater than one party could create by itself. So insofar as the New World Order, it's always been an idea through time where people who worship themselves and worship their ego take it upon themselves to say, here's how we should run the world, and it doesn't matter about the little people who don't know about this because they're not smart enough to care and they need to be told what to do. And that's exactly what Plato tells you in the Republic when he's designing this utopia. It's all about the intellectual elite. It's not education for everybody. It's specialized roles. It tells you when you can and can't have sex. It tells you how to have babies in a society after having sex on these four ritual dates a year. So Plato's Republic is a deep, deep masterpiece of literature. But how it applies to everyday man is not necessarily directly taught in our education system, because in teaching it, you would understand the structure that you're kind of controlled by, and thereby you would find the way out. Well, it's this famous allegory called the Allegory of the Cave. And basically, it's this underground cave, and you've got a screen right here. And on the screen, there's cast these shadows from this fire. And in between the fire and the wall, you've got these prisoners. And they're all shackled, so they can only see straight forward, and they can't turn their head, and they can't get up, and they can't look behind them or anything. So they're just looking ahead all the time at these shadows on the wall. And they take these shadows to be the most real forms of things, because they haven't escaped outside to see, you know, trees and sunlight and all these things. They think the shadows on the wall are the most real things, and they talk about these illusions as if they're real. And then one day, one of these prisoners breaks out and overcomes the guards, and he gets outside and he sees things for how they really are, and he's like, wow, people inside should see this. They should come out here and check this out, and I'm going to go inside and tell them, look at this reality and look what's going on. And so the allegory is showing people that there are various forms of reality. That which you see on TV, the Congress, the president speaking to the American people, all these things, that's a type of theater that's created. And they use actors, and there's producers, and there's studios, and there's handlers, and there's agents, and there's all these people in the form of lobbyists and special interests and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So you have this illusion that's given to people, and whether it's in Plato's Republic 2,500 years ago, or it's this past week watching the president tell us, we're going to pull out of Afghanistan, but first we've got to send another 30,000 troops. And it's like, okay, you can only hold contradictory ideas in the same mindset for so long, because that's what leads to schizophrenia. That's what George Orwell called doublethink and double speak. And these ideas of holding duplicitous contradictory ideas within the same mindset. And that's what happens when you have a government that says whatever it needs to tell you to get what it wants, and then it goes and does something completely different, because they were never interested in that which they sold you on. They just wanted your approval so that they could take these resources and do this selfish thing over here that doesn't empower people. If you go out to the internet and you Google New World Order, you're not likely to find a succinct and accurate definition. However, by going to the older literature, you know, pre-internet, something called books. I like to use these kind of as exhibits, because they show you, you know, pieces of history. And it's like, there's a book by Eustace Mullins called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. And what Eustace Mullins did was he read about 5,400 volumes of congressional transcripts and the actual documents that were involved in the creation of the Federal Reserve. And he spent years in the Library of Congress researching all the documents he could get his hands on the creation of the Federal Reserve and who owns it, what's its purpose, and how does it interact with the American people and whatnot. And subsequent to that book, he wrote this book called The World Order. And The World Order builds upon the secrets of the Federal Reserve, and also goes into the origins of how these ideas have transgressed over time and lost some of the essence that maybe Plato and some of these other intellectuals had tried to put out there. And these techniques and what Aristotle referred to as rhetoric, which is the use of persuasive speech. Mm-hmm. And when you look at this New World Order, this ruling elite, this superclass, if you will, they use rhetoric as their form of government. That is how they control people, literally through words and effective use of argument, effective use of fallacies that shouldn't be passed for truth. But the American public, through its education system, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, has literally been dumbed down. They've had the critical thinking aspects taken out of their education system, and that leaves us all bathing in this constant sea of propaganda and advertising and public relations, and the nuances presented to us through the news are not the whole of that food. They are being stripped of the vital nutrients of truth, and they're presenting these certain perspectives that only empower truthfully, they only empower their advertisers, the publicly traded corporations that are advertising through the news, that are helping to shape that news content, and these news corporations are suppressing news because it's profitable to lie to the public. So when you have media companies betraying the trust that they're supposed to have with their audience in order to satiate the advertisers and the money relationships that they have set up, that's all kind of the grassroots network, if you will, of the New World Order. That's how it gets fed. Another book that is, I thought, highly interesting because you don't see it out there. You don't hear people talking about it that often. It's called With No Apologies by Senator Barry M. Goldwater. And it was written, I believe it was published in 1979, but let's take a look real quick. Barry M. Goldwater was elected U.S. Senator from Arizona. He served two terms in the Senate until 1964, at which time he received the Republican nomination for the presidency and waged an unsuccessful campaign against the incumbent, President Lyndon Johnson. So, he was a senator. He was there through four different presidents, I believe. So in chapter 33, which he titled The Non-Elected Rulers, he talks about Colonel House and how we got engaged as the United States in World War I. And how out of that they created something called the Council on Foreign Relations, which was set up between Colonel House and other attendees of the Paris Peace Conference, as well as J.P. Morgan and some other interesting characters. So he's already letting us know that there are non-elected rulers, that these people have been in control since the end of World War I, and in fact they are the people who got us into World War I. And he goes on to talk about something called the Trilateral Commission in addition to the Council on Foreign Relations. But I just wanted to read you this quote from Rear Admiral Chester Ward of the United States Navy, who was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations for 16 years. And he says, regarding the Council on Foreign Relations, the most powerful clique in these elitist groups have one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of sovereignty and the national independence of the United States. Their goal is to impose a benign stability on the quarreling family of nations through merger and consolidation. They see the elimination of national boundaries and the suppression of racial and ethnic loyalties as the most expeditious avenue to world peace. Their rationale rests exclusively on materialism. They believe economic competition is at the root of international tension. This approach dismisses as insignificant the form of government or the political ideology expressed by that form. It may be that if the CFR vision of the future could be realized, there would be a reduction in wars, a lessening in poverty, a more efficient utilization of the world's resources. To mind, this would inevitably be accomplished by a loss of personal freedom of choice and the reestablishment of restraints which provoked the American Revolution. When we change presidents, it's understood to mean the voters are ordering a change in national policy. When a new president comes on board, there is a great turnover in personnel, but no change in policy. Example, during the Nixon years, Henry Kissinger, CFR member, and Nelson Rockefeller's protege, was in charge of the foreign policy. When Jimmy Carter was elected, Kissinger was replaced by Zbigniew Brzezinski, CFR member and David Rockefeller's protege. So even when the president changes, there's no change in policy. It's a right leg and a left leg, and they're stepping toward their goal, and both legs are attached to the same torso in the form of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Group, the Bilderberg Group. These are the actual working groups of the New World Order. And so the last part I wanted to share was on the Trilateral Group, and this is what Senator Goldwater had to say about that. The implications of Governor Rockefeller's presentation have become concrete proposals advanced by David Rockefeller's newest international cabal, the Trilateral Commission. Whereas the Council on Foreign Relations is distinctly national in membership, the Trilateral Commission is international. Representation is allocated equally to Western Europe, Japan, and the United States. It's intended to be a vehicle for the multinational consolidation of the commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States. Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller screened and selected every individual who was invited to participate in shaping and administering the proposed New World Order. In the late 1950s, Brzezinski, an accepted member of the inner circle of academics, asserting the need for global strategies, was openly anti-communist. I'd also add that Zbigniew Brzezinski was on the board of Amnesty International. So when you look at these groups that are supposed to be out there fighting for human rights, you also have to realize that at some point in the past they were subverted, and they continue to use their logos and their personnel and everything like that, like nothing ever happened. That is the modus operandi of the New World Order. They subvert by taking over leadership, and then they control the whole group invisibly. It's very similar to how the toothpaste company Toms of Maine, which made its fame from being this wholesome, natural, fluoride-free toothpaste, was recently purchased by Colgate, but the Toms of Maine customers are never informed. The package looks the same, everything's the same, except now they put fluoride into it, which defeats the whole purpose of buying that brand in the first place. The last quote I would like to read from Goldwater's autobiography, titled With No Apologies, The Personal and Political Memoirs of a United States Senator, is this. Goldwater's words. In my view, the Trilateral Commission represents a skillful, coordinated effort to seize control and consolidate the four centers of power, political, monetary, intellectual, and ecclesiastical. This is to be done in the interest of creating a more peaceful, more productive world community. Throughout my life and in these pages, I've refrained from judging other men's motives. I have no such hesitancy in judging their wisdom and the results of the actions taken. So, and then it goes into the Kyoto, Japan, and the global warming, and how they're going to pull that off. Superclass. Mm-hmm. Written by David Rothkopf, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So here's a Council on Foreign Relations writer telling you that there's a superclass, that they're not elected by you. It just has to do with people at international companies having a lot of money and on boards of directors of many other international entities. So there's also another book by a Council on Foreign Relations author, Fareed Zakaria, and the title of the book is The Post-American World. So the cover of the book says it all. You know, they've got the world on their keychain, and they're taking your world for a ride, right? And so it's like, we live on this world too. And if we can read these books, and these guys are clearly telling us, they're controlling America, they're not elected, they're not acting in our best interest, they don't care about the American people, they don't care about all the families who have worked hard over the years, building up, trying to give a better life to their kids and propagate the American dream, I think it's about time that we just recognize there are these people out there with opposite agendas, and they seek to dissolve the borders of America and all the rest of the countries. And it's not in the interest of any of the people living in these countries. It's rather to suit the needs of an intellectual elite who are using these ideas against the rest of us who are helpless because we've lost our ability to think critically about these topics. Now, if it was put out in 2,500 years ago in Plato's Republic, and it's been brought forth by the intellectual elite, I'd say we have a pretty good idea of what their plan is, what their thoughts are. We just have to get into their books and start reading these things. I mean, another book that we have someplace around here is The Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes. And in there, he clearly states that he wishes to create a secret society. He wishes to control the souls of the intellectual elite of our schools by providing these Rhodes scholarships for the next 200 years. And so starting in 1902, they went out and formed working groups based on his will, using his money from the De Beers diamond mines in Rhodesia and South Africa and all these different places. And they started to systematically subvert American sovereignty, the rights of individuals, the rights of states, the rights of our national Congress and whatnot. And they externalized the power structure to a Federal Reserve Board of Directors that were chosen by Colonel House, as it states in his own personal, you know, private letters, four-volume set. It tells you that all of this stuff is right there. And then the question becomes, if all of this is there and it's all valid and it's all in their books, why are we not taught about this in our schools? The last thing I mentioned is a film called The American Ruling Class, which is put together by Lewis Lapham and a couple other elite personalities. And what he does is goes through and asks the question, is there a ruling class? Is there an American ruling class, a group of people who are not elected, who actually run this country? And he showed tons of examples throughout, going to Council on Foreign Relations members, Skull and Bones members, Rhodes Scholars, Trilateral Commission members, people who go to Bohemian Grove. Here they all are. Here's what they do. Here's their resumes. Yes, they're in control, and they're not ashamed to tell you about it, which means they think you can't do anything about it. And the only thing we need to do to get out of this problem is read books and communicate to each other and learn to think critically through those processes. That's it. And in doing that, that is the whole solution to this problem that they've created. And they're depending on us not to do our reading, not to do our homework. That's what Alan Dulles said. That's how they got away with the Kennedy assassination. The American public doesn't read. And that doesn't have to be true anymore. And especially today, with a lower quality of entertainment on television than I've ever seen during my whole lifetime, I think it's just begging us to go and find some used books. It's not about spending money. You can get many of these books online in electronic form. But the idea is to change our habits and to start reading some of the books that are empowering to us instead of all this self-help mumbo-jumbo that's just there to tell you, hey, you're not thinking positive enough, right? Because that's not what it's about.
If, as Albert Einstein asserted, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, then possibly the definition for sanity is learning or the ability to learn. He also said that you can't solve a problem from the same level of consciousness that created it, suggesting that we have to expand our awareness, take in new information, and we need a process for that learning. We need a process for taking in new information and critically weighing and considering that information, integrating what is useful and discarding what is garbage or toxic or not useful. And we have the capacity for learning, whether you believe in evolution or you believe in creationism. We have a cerebral cortex, and we certainly have the capacity for learning. That's only half the equation, though. Like I said, we need an operating system. And that operating system is typically instilled in us early on through our education, K through 12, and beyond. The national curriculum of schooling that we have now is designed exactly as if someone had set out to prevent children from learning how to think and act, rather to coax them into addiction and dependent behavior. So what form of education do we have today? John Taylor Gatto argues that we have a form of compulsory schooling. Who is John Taylor Gatto? He was a New York City school teacher for 26 years. He was the New York State School Teacher of the Year. He shares his critique of compulsory schooling in Dumbing Us Down. And it's strong words from the New York State Teacher of the Year, the hidden curriculum of compulsory schooling. And what he has to say, he suggests that the national curriculum of schooling is designed exactly as if someone had set out to prevent children from learning how to think and act, rather to coax them into addiction and dependent behavior. In fact, he argues, the very stability of our economy is threatened by any form of education that might change the nature of the human product schools now turn out. The economy school children currently expect to live under and serve would not survive a generation of young people trained, for example, to think critically. It's interesting, you talk about the trivium and the quadrivium and the seven liberal arts. John Taylor Gatto describes the seven-lesson school teacher. He admits teaching means different things in different places, but asserts that seven lessons are universally taught from Harlem to Hollywood Hills. And he says, "Believe me when I say I intend no irony in this presentation. These are the things that I teach. These are the things that you pay me to teach your children. And the first lesson I teach is confusion. Everything I teach is out of context. I teach the unrelating of everything. I teach disconnections. Even in the best schools, a close examination of curriculum and its sequences turns up a lack of coherence, full of internal contradictions." Gatto asserts that meaning and not disconnected facts is what sane human beings seek. Think of the great natural sequences, like learning to walk or learning to talk, the progression of light from sunrise to sunset, the ancient procedures of a farmer, or the preparation of a Thanksgiving feast. All of the parts are in perfect harmony with each other. Each action justifies itself and illuminates the past and the future. School sequences are nothing like that. Not inside a single class and not among the total menu of daily classes. I teach the unrelating of everything, the infinite fragmentation, the opposite of cohesion. I teach you how to accept confusion as your destiny. That is the first lesson I teach. Class position. The second lesson I teach is class position. I teach that students must stay in the class where they belong. I don't know who decides where my kids belong, but that's not my business. The children are numbered so that if any get away, they can be returned to the right class. If I do my job well, the kids can't even imagine themselves somewhere else because I have shown them how to envy and fear the better classes and how to have contempt for the dumb classes. Under this efficient discipline, the class mostly polices itself into good marching order, and that's the real lesson of any rigid competition like school. You come to know your place. I frequently insinuate the day will come when an employer will hire them on the basis of test scores and grades. Even though my own experience is that employers are rightly indifferent to such things. I never lie outright, but I've come to see that truth and school teaching are, at bottom, incompatible. just as Socrates said thousands of years ago. Indifference. The third lesson I teach is indifference. I teach children not to care too much about anything, even though they want to make it appear that they do. How I do this is very subtle. I do it by demanding that they become totally involved in my lessons, jumping up and down in their seats with anticipation, competing vigorously with each other for my favor. It's heartwarming when they do that. When I'm at my best, I plan lessons very carefully in order to produce this show of enthusiasm. But when the bell rings, I insist they drop whatever it is we've been doing and proceed quickly to the next workstation. Indeed, the lesson of bells is that no work is worth finishing, so why care too deeply about anything? Years of bells will condition all but the strongest to a world that can no longer offer important work to do. Bells inoculate each undertaking with indifference. Emotional dependency. The fourth lesson I teach is emotional dependency. By stars and red checks, smiles and frowns, prizes, honors, and disgraces. I teach kids to surrender their will to the predestinated chain of command. Rights may be granted or withheld by any authority without appeal, because rights do not exist inside a school. In fact, not even the right of free speech, as the Supreme Court has ruled, unless the school authorities say they do. Individuality is a contradiction of class theory, a curse to all systems of classification. Sometimes, free will appears right in front of me, in pockets of children angry, depressed, or happy about things outside my care. Rights in such matters cannot be recognized by school teachers, only privileges that can be withdrawn. Children are hostages to good behavior. Intellectual dependency. The fifth lesson I teach is intellectual dependency. Good students wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. It is the most important lesson that we must wait for other people better trained than ourselves to make the meanings of our lives. The expert makes all the important choices. Only I, the teacher, can determine what my kids must study. Or rather, only the people who pay me can make those decisions, which I then enforce. If I'm told that evolution is a fact instead of a theory, I transmit that as ordered, punishing deviants who resist what I have been told to tell them to think. This power to control what children will think lets me separate successful students from failures very easily. Successful children do the thinking I assign them with a minimum of resistance and a decent show of enthusiasm. Curiosity has no important place in my work, only conformity. Good people wait for an expert to tell them what to do. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that our entire economy depends upon this lesson being learned. Think of what might fall apart if children weren't trained to be dependent. The social services could hardly survive. They would vanish, I think, into the recent historical limbo out of which they arose. Counselors and therapists would look on in horror as the supply of psychic invalids vanished. Commercial entertainment of all sorts, including television, would wither as people learned again how to make their own fun. Restaurants, the prepared food industry, and a whole host of other assorted food services would be drastically downsized if people returned to making their own meals rather than depending on strangers to plant, pick, chop, and cook for them. Much of modern law, medicine, and engineering would go too, the clothing business and school teaching as well, unless a guaranteed supply of helpless people continued to pour out of our schools every year. In fact, we built a way of life that depends on people doing what they are told because they don't know how to tell themselves what to do. Provisional or conditional self-esteem. The sixth lesson I teach is provisional self-esteem. If you've ever tried to wrestle into line kids whose parents have convinced them to believe they'll be loved in spite of anything, you know how impossible it is to make self-confident spirits conform. Our world wouldn't survive a flood of confident people very long, so I teach kids that a kid's self-respect should depend on an expert opinion. My kids are constantly evaluated and judged. Self-evaluation, the staple of every major philosophical system that ever appeared on the planet, is never considered a factor. The lesson of report cards, grades, and tests is that children should not trust themselves or their parents, but should instead rely on the evaluation of certified officials. People need to be told what they are worth. One can't hide. The seventh lesson I teach is that one cannot hide. I teach students they are always watched, that each is under constant surveillance by myself and my colleagues. There are no private spaces for children. There is no private time. Class change lasts exactly 300 seconds to keep promiscuous fraternization at low levels. Students are encouraged to tattle on each other or even to tattle on their own parents. Of course, I encourage parents to file reports about their own child's waywardness, too. A family trained to snitch on itself isn't likely to conceal any dangerous secrets. The meaning of constant surveillance and denial of privacy is that no one can be trusted, that privacy is not legitimate. Surveillance is an ancient imperative espoused by certain influential thinkers, a central prescription set down in the Republic, in the City of God, in the Institutes of the Christian Religion, in New Atlantis, in Leviathan, and in a host of other places. All these childless men who wrote these books discovered the same thing. Children must be closely watched if you want to keep a society under tight central control.
Only a few lifetimes ago, things were very different in the United States. Originality and variety were common currency. Our freedom from regimentation made us the miracle of the world. Social class boundaries were relatively easy to cross. Our citizenry was marvelously confident, inventive, and able to do much for themselves independently and to think for themselves. We were something special. We were Americans, all by ourselves, without government sticking its nose into and measuring every aspect of our lives. Without institutions and social agencies telling us how to think and feel, we were something special as individuals, as Americans. Look again at the seven lessons of school teaching. Confusion, class position, indifference, emotional and intellectual dependency, conditional self-esteem, and surveillance. All of these lessons are prime training for permanent underclasses, people deprived forever of finding the center of their own special genius, and over time this training has shaken loose from its own original logic to regulate the poor. For since the 1920s, the growth of the school bureaucracy and the less visible growth of a horde of industries that profit from schooling exactly as it is has enlarged this institution's original grasp to the point that it now seizes the sons and daughters of the middle classes as well. His concern is what he asserts should be the concern of any thinking person in America regarding the harm being brought to the current generation of students in the public schooling system. This harm is the same which was visited upon their parents and indeed every generation of publicly schooled students over the last century in this country. We are now witnessing the accumulating negative effects of omitting the three means of learning how to learn, which constitute the integrated classical trivium, the first three of the seven liberal arts and sciences. In a classical primary and secondary education curriculum, the components of the trivium, general grammar, formal Aristotelian logic, and classical rhetoric, are presented to students to train them in learning how to learn and, concurrently, in validly thinking systematically. Once a student is conversant with this threefold procedural pattern, he is now capable of teaching himself, with minimal guidance from an instructor or facilitator, how to learn any established subject. Through the process of learning how to learn, he learns how to critically and creatively think for himself. This makes a person a first-hand independent thinker rather than remaining a second-hand dependent thinker. In not relying on his own organized thoughts, a second-hand thinker, usually one marked by low self-esteem, has his mental content filled by various so-called authorities like the mass media and its advertising, professionals and politicians, some of whom may be unscrupulous, officials both benign and despotic, in schools and in the workplace. A major reason the dame school or the one-room schoolhouse of the past, being taught by one instructor and upperclassmen, and the homeschooling movement now gaining traction, was and is successful, is that they use the trivium method of education. Success in this context is in producing appropriately critical, creative, self-sufficient individuals who become equipped to attract intellectual abundance into their lives as well as that which naturally follows from it, material abundance. The trivium forms a habitual pattern of mind of how to think effectively, not what to think. Because this is a method devoted to the how of thinking, it is not controversial. It is in the topics of what to think, religion, literature, philosophy, etc., where controversy reigns. The problem is, quote-unquote, general education has not been the focus of the contemporary schooling establishment, but rather social engineering. It is a vile and protracted form of miseducation. In not being trained to think critically and creatively, students are programmed in reading and thinking only to the level of abiding to instructions. In being aggressively indoctrinated not to think, and being programmed against our very nature, is it any wonder most of us live in a constant state of low-level fear and are anxiously disoriented in an ocean of chaos without the ability to judge as to what are appropriate and beneficial goods and values? Man cannot live long or maintain health without his primary means of survival, the exercise of his rational thought. Adolf Hitler said, "What luck for rulers that men do not think." If one is trained in the use of the trivium method, not only can he learn topics on his own, deduce particular rationale from particular protocols, but also develop intellectual and value judgment of a high order. Through the efficient attainment of knowledge and understanding, one's intellectual capacities are awakened.
Did I tell you that I found Dan Brown's lost symbol?
I'd love... What is Dan Brown's lost symbol?
I keep it in my pocket.
Oh, cool. I finally get to see it. Oh.
You tell Dan Brown that I found his lost symbol.
I will.
Return it to him. Be sure to return it
to him. I'll make sure I pass on
the
message.
He's looking for it.
I'll tell him I found
his double. Looking for the lost symbol of Freemasonry. Who was Cecil John Rhodes?
That's the question
on
my mind.
Is that a topic of interest? Let's check this out. Once upon a time, there was this gentleman named William T. Stead, who later dies on the Titanic. And William T. Stead invented something called the interview, where one person asks another person questions. So William T. Stead interviewed this guy named General Gordon, and this was back in the 1800s. So from then on, it became a very powerful piece of propaganda, a way to propagate ideas directly from one person to another via something called a dialogue, questions and answers, right? William T. Stead happened to publish several books as part of his role as a journalist, bringing information to people. And one of the books he published was called The Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes, with elucidatory notes by the testator, edited by William T. Stead. Very fancy title. And I'd heard about this book like it was some kind of myth. And I went out and sought the book, and I went to Amazon, and I went to different places where I buy used books, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I looked online at Scribd, and I looked for an electronic form. No one seemed to have this book out there. And there was one electronic library. If you go through worldcat.org, you can see where the libraries near you have these books. There was a couple law libraries, you know, around here that had it, and short of going to get permission to go into a law library, there was also one place online at archive.org that had a copy of this. And so I wanted to obtain a copy for myself, so I looked for this book for several years. I happened to come across a copy that I bought through a used book exchange that happens to be the actual copy owned by William T. Stead, sold to me by the guy who bought William T. Stead's entire archive, as Stead was the editor of a thing called The Review of Reviews, this magazine of the elite. And so the gentleman I purchased this book from owned the entire archives, all the library of The Review of Reviews, and he said, "This is William T. Stead's actual copy of the book." I was very excited when I got this in the mail, so take it out. We'll be careful. It's printed in 1902. Yeah, the protective bubble wrap turns out to try to eat the book. It's called The Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes, and this is a book that we are about to republish and re-release to the public because I think it contains some of the most important words in the free world. So it's titled The Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes, with elucidatory notes to which are added some chapters describing the political and religious ideas of the testator. So that's Cecil Rhodes, he's the testator. Edited by William Thomas Stead, London, the Review of Reviews Office, Norfolk, WC. I don't know what the WC means. 1902. That's the first edition. And on pages, as you can see, several pages are in Rhodes' own handwriting.
Wow.
This is Cecil John Rhodes in his own words. He says, quote, "Please remember, the key of my idea discussed with you is a society, copied from the Jesuits as the organization, the practical solution, a differential rate, and a copy of the United States Constitution." According to Rowe's last will and testament, the mandate is to set forth a secret society to be funded by his wealth as the De Beers diamond magnate and creator of Rhodesia, to create a secret society based on the tenets and the structure and organizational know-how of the Jesuits, but instead of being for Catholic aims, it's for the expansion and world domination of the British Empire under the idea of something called British Israelism, where the British monarchy claims to be related to characters from the early Bible. Rhodes says on page 73, quote, "What an awful thought it is that if we had not lost America, or if even now we could arrange with the present members of the United States Assembly in our House of Commons, the peace of the world is secured for all eternity. We could hold your federal parliament for 5 years at Washington and 5 at London. The only thing feasible to carry out this idea is a secret one, a society gradually absorbing the wealth of the world to be devoted to such an object, which is world domination or a new world order. And for anyone who doubts how the new world order or this idea of a one world government that's not elected, an elite ruling class taking care of all the business of the world and just basically giving you a theater to let you think that it is of your own choosing, when really it's through a mechanism of propaganda and continuous bombardment with these ideas telling you what to think, instead of teaching you how to think. If anyone has any of those doubts, you can look into a teacher from Georgetown University named Carol Quigley, who was the mentor of Rhodes scholar William Jefferson Clinton, who was also happened to be a president of the United States. Now, Quigley was a teacher at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and in his last lecture, a couple weeks before he died, he had this to say. Another thing which may serve to point out the instability of the power system of the state: the individual cannot be made the basic unit of society, as we have tried to do, or of the state, since the internalization of controls must be the preponderant influence in any stable society. He goes on to say, talking about this internalization of controls, that basically they can't control all the people on the planet through shock weapons and through physical man-to-man combat. So what they have to do is effectively use propaganda and the media to kind of control people's ideas and to control, basically have people police themselves. And he describes in his last lecture that the military-industrial complex and the media-industrial complex have combined forces because they realized that neither one could control the population by itself. So they kind of merged and conglomerated their forces so that they have a strategic and comprehensive system of control which affects you in a variety of ways throughout each and every day of your lives, because they're privatizing water. There's companies like Monsanto that's poisoning your food. By these groups prohibiting green solutions that have been used for thousands of years, like hemp, and standardizing us on a poisonous petrochemical carbon-emitting system, the corporations that are running the 500 largest moving vehicles on this planet to transport things back and forth emit more carbon than all the cars on the Earth. So when you're talking about things like global warming and all, you know, whether or not that exists, the point would be that even if global warming is brought into suspicion as to whether or not it's real, the reality is the corporations and the creation of an artificially obsolescent culture where we're producing more and more garbage, more and more pollution, these things do build up. That is a problem, but it's not being done by the individuals. And it's not something that's happened by accident. This has been in their plans since 1967 in the first documents that I've seen that successfully predict that we can cause a global warming stir. We can get people to get concerned about their environment. But in 1967, they were predicting that they would need to do like a generation to a generation and a half of heavy, heavy polluting before it would even become viable that people could believe that, right? So what you have here in Quigley's body of work is the Evolution of Civilizations, which gives you the history of maritime admiralty law, the use of commerce as a control mechanism to subvert populations without... The old way of war, the old form of war, was to go in and actually conquer your enemy, and they knew you conquered them. The new form of war, starting 6,000 years ago, was to subvert your enemy through controlling their commerce. And once you controlled commercial activity, you could leave the puppet government in place, right? So when the Carthaginians took over Rome, for instance, you don't see evidence of the Carthaginians in there actually managing Rome. The people who controlled the economy that took over the Carthaginians and then went and conquered other countries veil themselves through the ubiquity of commerce. Because you're born into the status quo, and money's always been here, and the people around you usually don't define it for you. And unless you go and look for yourself and define it, then it's just this thing like, you know, fish can't notice the water because they're always surrounded by the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
But every now and then you see a fish that goes and jumps out of the water, and he's like, hey, what was that? I just went out of this and came back into it. So there's something else there. We must be surrounded by this thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Quigley's Anglo-American Establishment, you have him explaining, on top of the evolution of civilizations, here's the modernized form. Here's what's going on. Here's the people that are running the world. Here's how they promised Palestine to three different groups of people at the same time. Here's why they gave it to a certain group of people, and here's why they didn't give it to these other people. And then understanding that and understanding World War I and World War II, you're prepared for Quigley's masterpiece, his magnum opus, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Now, had they just taught this one simple book to me in college, I could have saved thousands and thousands of hours of reading. But the fact is that this book, for years, was not available to the general public, that the plates were destroyed, that they did, you know, they tried to suppress it every which way, and still, 40 years later, it stands as the premier work of American history and the history of the Western world, because what's in this book comes from Carol Quigley, a Georgetown professor, spending 20 years in compiling this history, and 2 years among the Council on Foreign Relations private archives, which tells you the story of the 20th century. And so, having been so close to these groups and being able to put this body of work together and to lay out the history that's not taught to us in our schools, I thought it was the most tremendously powerful and paradigm-changing body of facts all put together in context such that you could understand. And it's a heavy book. I mean, not only is it heavy, it uses big words, but it's 1,348 pages, and you could read it and read it and read it and read it over and over and over again and continue to see how these things blend together. And it makes a lot of sense, because it's filling in all the blind spots that's provided through our traditional education. When Lisa read the excerpts from John Taylor Gatto's Dumbing Us Down, it builds out the structure of how they dumb us down, how they keep us from figuring out, how they keep us from learning on our own. In totality, that's what it is. John Taylor Gatto's work teaches us how they kept us from learning for ourselves, so we always have to be going to some teaching authority to get our information, right? But that's not how life works. You graduated school a long time ago, and now you're out in reality. So through reality, you're interacting with other people, and you're having conversations, and you're trying to figure out how these things all fit in. And in talking to our good friend Rick Malko, he had sent us a set of documents. He said, I can't find this online anywhere, but I have a Xerox printout, and it's from the 70s. It was somebody's newsletter, and it went through the suppression of education in the 20th century, and it was covering the Cox Committee and the Reese Committee, and it was talking about this guy, Norman Dodd, and I really just couldn't get my head around what it was saying. I knew it was telling me something. And I knew that Rick had gotten it from, a teacher that he had in high school, who later went through, she found out through the teaching system that they were really kind of teaching the teachers to brainwash the kids. And as a teacher, Mrs. Tickey was her name, Mrs. Tickey goes out and says, I'm going to look at the system, and why are they making us do this? And why aren't we teaching kids to learn? And why are we trying to condition kids? And so, Rick had gotten this document from Mrs. Tickey, and I'm reading through this document, and I cannot put my finger on it. It's like noise. It's like I'm trying to pick up the signal. I know there's something here, but I can't quite grasp it. And then a couple months go by, and I put the document aside, and I'm watching this interview with G. Edward Griffin and this guy named Norman Dodd. And Norman Dodd had gone to Andover, and he had gone to Yale, and then he worked at J.P. Morgan. And then it was during the Great Depression, and J.P. Morgan wanted to come to him and said, we want you to figure out what's going on with the banking industry and how to fix it. And he comes back and says, well, basically, the way you're doing banking is unsustainable. You have to tell the public about this and make this correction. And the bankers basically said, his bosses basically said, well, thank you for your opinion. We are going to continue doing this. We're just going to lie to the public, and you're no longer needed. So after leaving J.P. Morgan, after getting fired from J.P. Morgan, Norman Dodd goes and he becomes the director of research for something called the Reese Committee. And Carol Reese was a Tennessee senator or congressman who had started this committee to look into the gravity that these tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Carnegie Teaching Foundation, how these foundations weighed in and what effect they had on our education in America. And so finally, in starting to see this interview, and it's a first-person interview that J. Edward Griffin did in 1981 with Norman Dodd, who at that time was like 83 years old, Dodd is talking about 40 years earlier, and you know, or 30 years earlier in the 50s, and how he was director of research for this committee and what he found out. So Dodd's in charge of researching what effect these foundations have on American education. In preparation for putting this report together for the Congress, Norman Dodd gets all these file folders from this guy named Rene Wurmser. And one of the folders is marked Robert Hutchins. And that folder happens to be empty. It's the only empty folder that he gets. So he's looking into all this stuff and he says, what's going on here? And we'll come back to Robert Hutchins in a couple minutes. But the point is, in building up this body of factual evidence for the Congressional Committee headed up by Carol Reese, Norman Dodd gets this D.C. attorney named Catherine Casey, and she goes to New York to the Carnegie Endowment, and she reads their minutes from the board meetings. And about 1911, the trustees of the Carnegie Endowment raised the question. This is reading from page 60 of the Tax-Exempt Foundations by William McElhaney. So when Catherine Casey returned to Washington, she brings all these documents and all these minutes from the meetings that she had gone through and transcribed. And in 1911, the trustees for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace raised the question. They asked the question, and the question was specific. Is there any means known to man more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people? So they were seeking to change the lives of an entire society, not just small groups of people, seeking to change not only American education, but how Western education is taught throughout the world. It's an international nonprofit foundation. And they discussed this, and at the end of the year, they came to the conclusion that there was no more effective means to that end known to man. So then they raised the second question, and that question was, how do we involve the United States in a war? The point is, the Carnegie Endowment wanted to know how to bring the United States into war. And to bring the United States into war, you control its diplomats. And to control its diplomats, you control the education. And they also found a couple other benefits of controlling education. The essence of the Tax-Exempt Foundations book by McElhaney illustrates the fact that these international foundations, the Carnegie, the Guggenheim, the Rockefeller foundations, were seeking to have an adverse effect on American educations. Rather, more specifically, they were seeking to dumb our children down so that those children could grow up to be adults, to have children that were continually dumbed down through the whole century. And through this dumbing down, they could effectively wage wars using rhetoric that was sophist in nature, which is effective rhetoric used for misdirection or a malicious means. It's the use of persuasive speech in the forms of public relations and propaganda, and getting our soldiers through Frank Capra's Why We Fight 7 video series, showing all this propaganda that actually and factually is not true, but is used to dehumanize another population because that's the only way you can get people to effectively wage war. So at the end of the day, they discovered war is a very effective means of profiting. And at World War I's inception, they discussed, hey, how can we get these other countries, more profitable countries like the United States with all their new toys, how can we get them involved? And they get involved. And then the question was, how do we continue this war? How do we get these societies, even after the war, to continue producing and consuming and producing and consuming without the stress of war? And they decided that you could come in and do a couple of things. You could remove critical thinking. And that would allow the propaganda to pour in because no one would have an effective means to tell if, to discern fact from fiction, to discern reality from illusion. And any culture that has lost the ability to discern fact from fiction, reality from illusion, has perished within one generation. So the idea is that not only could you take somebody's critical thinking out and insert propaganda, but if you did that over many generations, then people would lose the ability to even see the value in critical thinking. Now, Critical thinking comes as a result of having a couple key ideas placed in mind. And these key ideas have been handed down generation to generation for over 6,000 years. And up until about 100 years ago, these ideas were taught in the one-room schoolhouse. So it's not that far removed from where we are today. But the fact that these techniques, these lost tools of learning, have been taken out of our educational system specifically to create empty-minded consumers who don't question anything, who wait for an expert to tell them what to do and take instructions without question. That is what our children are being groomed into, conditioned into. They're not being taught how to learn. They're being told what to learn. They're being groomed into a service-oriented society instead of getting a liberal education where they could work, you know, from a perspective of free choice, an informed choice. And those choices are the result of critical thinking and a process that's been used through time. The Great Conversation is the first book in a 54-volume series printed in 1953. And the key author that put this all together is a gentleman named Robert Hutchins. This private library edition of the great books of the Western world was originally made possible in 1952 by the generous support of the subscribers to the Founders Edition. Now, I was interested. Who were the Founders Edition were? Who are these 500 bright-minded people? And you've got people like David Ben-Gurion. You've got the Rockefellers. You've got the Vanderbilts. You've got Edward Bernays. You've got, you know, any other number of names in here, but the 500 people who bought this book were the who's who. These books were made for the elite to teach themselves, to teach their children the things that they won't even put out in a public university. Unless you go to certain prep schools or certain Ivy League schools or join certain mystery schools like the Freemasons or the Rosicrucians or any number of ancient mystery schools that are out there, the only way to get this education is to A, know about it, and B, go set about reading The Great Conversation, because what you have is something called the tradition of the West, and everything we see around us comes from someplace. Even the pillars on buildings, those come from thousands of years of architectural tradition. So our words and our ideas and our ways of persuasive speech are much the same way. In Chapter 4, Robert Hutchins goes into the disappearance of a liberal education. I don't have time to read that, but it's interesting. What I want to get to is Chapter 10, A Letter to the Reader. And he says, "We say that these books contain a liberal education and that everyone ought try to get one. You say that either you've had one, or that you're not bright enough to get one, or that you do not need one." Now this is where Hutchins had me. And he says, "You cannot have had one. If you're an American under the age of 90, you can have acquired in the educational system only the faintest glimmerings of the beginnings of a liberal education." So in 1952, Robert Hutchins, who had been on the cover of Time magazine like three times in his lifetime, he's saying that the liberal education has been taken out of our education system for 90 years. So he's telling you in 1952 that for 90 years, the liberal education has been denied to everybody in America. What would it look like if you took away the ability to think critically from the American population for 90 years before 1952? And then just picture what's happened since 1952, because until recently, I haven't heard much talk about the liberal education or what it even means to be able to understand the works of Homer and Aristotle and Plato, all the way up through Thomas Malthus and all these. This is the New World Order's education. This is where they get their ideas. They're not getting them from the public school system. So unless we go and learn and read the books that they've read and understand where they're trying to take everything, we can continue to guess every day as the newspapers tell us one thing on this page and another thing on this page, just to confuse us. They're looking for a zero-sum game. It's like, you're confused. That's all they want. They're not looking to purvey information or share knowledge through that system. So in the liberal education, what it is it's all the works of Western culture's literature in chronological order. Because as writers progressed, let's say, you know, you have Aristotle, and he has read the work of Plato and Socrates and Homer, right? And by the time you get to Dante, he's read everyone before him. You know, so it's the continued chiming in of intellects throughout history, all talking about the same things, because what Plato was talking about in the Republic 2,500 years ago is exactly what's going on today. Whether it's the allegory of the cave, whether it's the elite trying to make a utopia, whether it's the union of opposites and trying to have a coincidentia oppositorum where you unite these opposites and it's all explained from a new perspective being added. You know, what you're talking about in this 54-volume set is it starts out with Homer, and it goes into Plato, then it goes into Aristotle and Sophocles and Plutarch, and then you get into, you know, the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and all the great, you know, all the great writers that have been used to create the ideas that are controlling us at this very moment, that are forming government, that are forming the status quo, that are forming the economy, and, you know, the cyclical repeating of lies, and people continue to buy into it. This is all part of history repeating itself. And the only way we can stop history from repeating itself is to learn our history, recognize the patterns, and say, oh, I'm recognizing a pattern. Let's do something different. Let's just try to change it up. Let's break some tradition or break some status quo, because that is change. That is how change happens. If you're doing the same thing you were yesterday, if you're adhering to the status quo, if you were honoring tradition, you are not changing anything, and you are precipitating the same problems today as people had 2,500 years ago. I think we all have a civic responsibility to start to understand not only the privileges that we have, but also the rights that we have, and those responsibilities that we have around money and understanding what money is before we go voting in a new way to do money in this country. Understand, what is the purpose of paying interest to foreign bankers and a substantial amount of the bailout money going to foreign banks? People need to be able to ask questions and have some sort of accountability with their government, because it is not government unless you are giving your consent to it. If you're not giving your consent to it, then that is either tyranny or terrorism or choose your name, but it's not freedom. Coming into the 20th century, the ideas and machinations of the espoused New World Order, this idea of getting the whole planet under the control of one person, came in a political and a religious form. In the political form, you have this thing called Fabian socialism. And in the religious form, you had this thing called theosophy, which is the mixture of God and these different religions with sophism, which is found in Plato's Republic. This is the use of effective rhetoric and persuasive speech for misdirective or misleading purposes. So you mix the theosophy and the Fabian socialism, and you have the ingredients of the New World Order. You have the ingredients of the operating system of the New World Order, both religious and political. Now, people who were members of both these groups, Theosophy and Fabian Socialists, include William T. Stead, H.G. Wells, right? So you have people who have written books about the New World Order or have been an executor to the will of someone who said, I want to create a secret society to achieve this New World Order, being Cecil Rhodes. So the idea is that you have this Theosophy, which uses, for instance, a symbol of the swastika, which was also used by Rudyard Kipling pre 20th century on the spine of his books. So this was an Indian sun symbol that was found by a British journalist, Rudyard Kipling, who was also a Freemason while he was in India. This then later becomes the symbol of the Nazi Party, and it's an interesting trek of the swastika in between. However, at this point in the early 20th century, you've got people participating in the consequence of Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament, that being the roundtable work groups, which were then spun off into the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the North American extension of Cecil Rhodes' legacy. At the same time, they created groups like Tavistock in order to control people's public opinion about the upcoming war with Germany, and after the war, managing what people were to think of the situation created by the Versailles Treaty. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about these Fabian socialists, and this is easy enough to Google, the Fabian socialist emblem, their avatar, if you will, was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And there's actually pictures of stained glass windows where the Fabian socialists are standing on either side, and they're pounding the world with these big hammers. And they're talking about shaping it into the image that they're picturing for the world. And when you have an emblem that is a wolf in sheep's clothing, that's very telling. But if you do another Google search and search out who is Fabius, where does Fabian socialism come from, You learn that Fabius became a Roman dictator because Hannibal was threatening Rome, and the Roman people panicked. And he said, I can stop Hannibal. And he did. He did this through a war of attrition, which was a long, prolonged, drawn-out war where you're denying the other side the resources that needs to exist. This then became the philosophy of the Fabian socialists, who then domineered the 20th century in their image. Propaganda is everywhere. Every documentary, every film you've ever seen is a piece of propaganda, technically, because it's trying to propagate a view. It's trying to propagate certain pieces of information. It may claim to be objective. It may be actually near that goal. But at the end of the day, every single piece of media is a piece of propaganda. And the only question is it helping you to expand your consciousness, or is it working to suppress your consciousness? Is it helping you express who you are, or is it working to suppress and tell you who you are, right? These are the ideas that we need to seek out. Is the person presenting you this information trying to offer you something to help you, or are they trying to make money off of your ignorance? Are they trying to raise your level of awareness, or are they trying to suppress your awareness and put you in a box so that they can profit from the difference? The Trivium and Quadrivium is a system of how you can process knowledge that has been time-tested for 6,000 years that teaches you how to think creatively and critically. It teaches you how to learn, not what to learn. So in understanding the Trivium, it enables you to learn any subject. In 1947 at Oxford University, there was a speech given by a woman named Dorothy Sayers. And in that speech, which was called The Lost Tools of Learning, she talks about something called the Trivium and the Quadrivium, which in the medieval times were the names given to the system of grammar, logic, rhetoric, mathematics, geometry, music, and astronomy. And for 6,000 years prior to that, this system of knowledge was used to discern reality from illusion, fact from fiction. It was what you used as a proverbial bullshit detector. And everyone armed with this knowledge was able to go through their reality and discern for themselves. They didn't necessarily need a teacher. They could act as an autodidactic person, a self-learning, self-teaching entity that would then go and communicate and even debate and argue in structured ways for purposes of coming to an agreement and a better understanding of things. So classically, this was the way that educated people went about exchanging ideas and improving ideas and coming up with new discoveries. The speech given by Dorothy Sayers, The Lost Tools of Learning, has a quote that I found toward the end to be quite revealing. And it says, she said, quote, "But I'm not here to consider the feelings of the academic bodies like Oxford. I'm concerned with only the proper training of the mind to encounter and deal with the formidable mass of undigested problems presented to it by the modern world. For the tools of learning," talking about the Trivium and Quadrivium, "are the same in any and every subject. And the person who knows how to use them will, at any age, get the mastery of a new subject in half the time with quarter of the effort expended by the person who has not the tools at his or her command. To learn six subjects without remembering how they were learnt does nothing to ease the approach to a seventh subject. To have learnt and remembered the art of learning makes the approach to every subject." Picture the Trivium as a triangle with sides 3, 4, and 5. That hypotenuse, that 5, is your 5 senses. The 3 are grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And on the bottom, the 4 is a quadrivium, the mathematics, the geometry, the music, and the astronomy. The question is, what is grammar? Like, we all had grammar in school, but no one's quite sure what it is for the most part. When you go out in the street, if you go out and do man-on-the-street interviews, no one knows what grammar is. Mm-hmm. Grammar is essentially discovering the facts of reality. It's gaining your essential knowledge. The logic aspect tests it and verifies that it makes sense in its structure. The rhetoric aspect is where you go and take these ideas that you've learned through knowledge and understanding, and you turn it into wisdom. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when shared. So in the rhetoric aspect, you're taking your knowledge out there, you're sharing it with others, usually in some sort of dialectic process or dialogue process, where you're taking two sides and pounding them into each other to get the result, which is clearer and more accurately articulated than the initial two arguments. And so through this process of communication, you come to larger and larger understandings that have greater and greater accuracy. So when they took the Trivium and Quadrivium out of our education system, And we were left with no way to discern fact from fiction, reality from illusion. We had no way to discern whether or not the person arguing on TV was using emotionally based and anchored fallacies, or if they were making accurate and sustainable arguments. By learning the trivium and quadrivium, you have a mechanism through which you can take all the information that you're taking in through the day, process it, take out the fallacies, take out the illusions, take out the rhetoric, take out the rumor, and be left with hard facts that are in context and are under that you can articulate to other people, and you can transfer this understanding to other people. In other words, it's like a virus scan for your mind. You have this virus scanner in your computer that's watching all the connectivity between the internet. Well, your computer's internet connection is monitored by this virus scan, and it tests everything coming into your computer to make sure it's factual and not some sort of virus or meme or something that's going to wreck your computer, i.e. your operating system or your understanding of reality. Mm-hmm. So, in effect, if you have a computer and it's, you know, let's say $2,000, and you spent the money to get a virus scan system on there, well, how much is your mind worth? Your mind is priceless. So you've been going through X amount of years of your life purposely without a virus scan system, without some way to discern whether or not you have factual reality or you're getting somebody else's creative public relations, PR, propaganda, bullshit story of this thing. You can immediately see, oh, they're using this, these different fallacies. They're trying to elicit this emotional response. They're appealing to these experts, what have you. These things have been proven to be misleading because they can't actually support the facts, so they have to cover it with all these fallacies. And it sounds like a good story on the surface a lot of times, but when you look into this and you see who the authors are and you see who the authors get their money from and you follow the money through the Council on Foreign Relations mouthpieces, and then here it is in our political policy, and here's what the diplomats talking about this stuff, it's all connected. And the reason that we can't see it as a people is because we've lost our ability to think critically in a structured manner where we can communicate to each other and say, hey, this guy's using this broad generalization, this ad hominem attack, and then this hasty generalization, and he's trying to make a point that everyone's believing, when in fact, none of these things would stand up to scrutiny. Without the trivium and quadrivium, you lose the ability for people to recognize why things are inaccurate, why these arguments are not reasonable, why they're not logical, why they don't stand up to critical thinking. And you learn to fill in these voids that were artificially created in the first place by these foundations taking over our education system and purposely creating these blind spots so that they could apply public relations and propaganda throughout all of the media. Well, I could start in 1886 with Supreme Court Justice Morrison R. Waite, who happened to be a Skull and Bones initiate from Yale University. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1886, in two sentences, without debate, gives corporations the same rights as human beings. Now, corporations not having a body to prosecute nor a soul to save act very much, in a publicly traded sense, as sociopaths or psychopaths. Now, when you give a sociopath or a psychopath the same rights as we give human beings, and you allow those corporations to act as proxies, and when you understand that these corporations used to have charters that expired and had to be renewed and they had to prove that they had some sort of value to the public worth, these corporations now fester on and become these monsters that are no longer driven by any sort of idealism other than profit at all costs. And the boards of directors and the executives are mandated to profit at all costs, even if that means, especially, necessarily that means externalizing their cost to people who are out there who don't know what's going on. When you're getting something and it's so cheap, you're like, I can't believe I can get this piece of electronics or any material goods so cheap. You're not really paying for that. They've externalized the cost. The cost went to poisoning the people downstream. The cost went to cheating the shippers. The cost went to the slave labor. That's who's really paying for it with their lives. You didn't really get that for $2.99. You didn't really get that big bag of crab legs for $3.99. Like, it's not fiscally feasible. It's not possible economically to get that. You have to understand, when you're getting something that cheap, you are not paying for it. That's why you're getting it so cheap. Somebody is robbing Peter to pay Paul on the other side, to use a biblical euphemism, which I don't necessarily even know if I agree with, but you get what I'm saying, yeah. Right? I mean, the whole idea is They've effectively used this propaganda to get us to use our fear. They use fear, which is meant to be a survival mechanism, to our own demise. Humanity, because they're shying away from the fear of looking the advertisers in the face and say, really? Really? You no longer even tell me the characteristics of the product you're advertising, let alone its benefits or why it's better than the competition. It's all about taking a new Beatles, like, it's all about taking a Beatles song, connecting it to your wallet, and once they have your emotion in the commercial, you don't even know what the product is. You want it. And they have conditioned us like Pavlov's dogs or Skinner's box or however you want to describe it, you know. The human behavior experiments did not end in the 60s. They go on every day, every couple minutes in your advertisements in these network shows. They expect you to watch the news and then all of a sudden, hey, take this drug, do this, right? You're taking in information from an authority and you're like, this is supposed to be truth. This is the news. Well, when it goes to commercial, do you turn that off? No, you're like, this is the doctor telling me, you know, this is them educating you on what you're supposed to act like, what you're supposed to think, what you're supposed to do, right? And these are all aspects of mass media propaganda, public relations that have existed pre-television. And no, they don't teach us about this in our schools normally. But people need to understand this.
Have I talked about the public opinion propaganda?
All right, before I talk about them, I want to talk about the the results or the consequences of propaganda.
Yeah.
Right, Smedley Darlington Butler was a major general in the Marine Corps, was the most highly decorated soldier of his time, 2-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner, who also busted the so-called plot, it's called the business plot. It was 1934, 1935, these businessmen sought to overthrow FDR, and they went to Butler and said, hey, we've got all these men, we want you to lead them and launch a coup against FDR, and he said, I don't think so. The guy who went to him to make the bribe was this guy named Jerry Maguire, and show me, you know, they said, we'll show you the money, and he said, I don't want to see it. He said, I don't need to see your money, he's a Quaker. In 1935, Butler wrote, War is a racket. And he starts out, War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one in international scope. It is the only one which profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. War is a racket. It can effectively be smashed only by taking the profits out of war. Well, Smedley Butler used to work as a for-hire hitman, basically. The corporations hire out the military, and they send Smedley Butler into all these countries, Honduras, Central America, all these different places, to subvert the governments militarily, and it softens it up so the corporations can come in with the least amount of resistance. Now, Edward Bernays wrote this book in 1928. This is a reprint, still a very popular book, used in most corporate marketing and advertising firms. The book is called Propaganda, 1928, Edward Bernays, who is the nephew of Sigmund Freud. So he's got this thing in here called Chapter 1, Organizing Chaos. Now I might note that the last words in his book are Order Out of Chaos. I don't know where I've heard that before, but I digress. Organizing Chaos, Chapter 1, Propaganda, Edward Bernays, 1928. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in a democratic society. They forgot to teach me that in school. I missed this part, right? Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds molded, our taste formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we've never heard of. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. Our invisible governors are, in many cases, unaware of the identity of their fellow members in the inner cabinet. They govern us by their qualities of natural leadership, their ability to supply needed ideas, and by their key position in social structure. We are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and the social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires and control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. It is not usually recognized how necessary these invisible governors are to the orderly functioning of our group life. We have voluntarily agreed to let an invisible government sift the data and high-spot the outstanding issues so that our field of choice shall be narrowed to practical proportions. With the printing press and the newspaper, the railroad, the telephone, the telegraph, radio, and airplanes, ideas can be spread rapidly and even instantaneously all over the whole of America. H.G. Wells senses the vast potentialities of these inventions when he writes in the New York Times, quote, "Modern means of communication, the power afforded by print, telephone, wireless, and so forth, of rapidly putting through directive, strategic, or technical conceptions of a great number of cooperating centers, of getting quick replies and effective discussion, have opened up a new world of political processes. Ideas and phrases can now be given an effectiveness greater than effectiveness of any personality and stronger than any sectional interest. The common design can be documented and sustained against perversion and betrayal. It can be elaborated and developed steadily and widely without personal, local, and sectional misunderstanding." The Tavistock Institute of Human Relations was created in 1913 at Wellington House. Now, among the elite who created this were Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann. Tavistock began as a propaganda creating and disseminating organization centered at Wellington House, where the original organization was put together with the intent of shaping a propaganda center that would break down the stiff public resistance being encountered to the looming war between Britain and Germany. So this is prior to World War I. This group gets together as a function of Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament. They start to put together the ideas of how to psychologically control the actions and public opinion of the masses. And in doing so, they discover not only can we involve America in a war, but we can also convince its people that the war is a good idea for them. That the Germans, of which there's a large German population at that time, that the Germans are evil. They're able to use propaganda effectively to drum up an idea of inhumanity so they can dehumanize the German people and push America's assets into the war. Coming out of the war, after the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, you've got people like Bernays and Lippmann who write these books for the corporations to help effectively keep the war culture going and the consumerism and the spending going. And this is where the first extensions of credit go out to the American people in the 20s. So the Roaring 20s is because they're given this credit, right? Mm-hmm. As a function of the Roaring 20s and the extension of this credit, advertising moves from a strategic, here's the functionality and why you should buy my product, to associating it with your emotions and attaching it down here to your wallet. Starts in 1922 with Walter Lippmann and his book, Public Opinion. In here, on the first page, before it even says part one, he illustrates the story of the allegory of the cave. So the first thing that Walter Lippmann thinks you need to know about public opinion is the allegory of the cave. And that leads you into the allegory of the cave is used as the metaphor to instruct everyone reading this manual. You are talking about fooling the people who are watching the shadows on the wall, and this book's all about how to create the shadows on the wall so that they don't see the real things outside, so that they never have a clue that they're missing out on anything. There's nothing behind the curtain. Just watch your shadows on the wall, watch your TV, watch your moving pictures, whatever it is, it's propaganda, right? 1928, Edward Bernays comes along, he pens his book called Propaganda. It builds on Lippmann's 1922 work on public opinion. Mm-hmm. This is actually how they manufacture it. So between Bernays and Lippmann separately and their work together at Tavistock, they had figured out how to use mass media to effectively fool any population, and at the same time the people who are creating and running Tavistock and the Council on Foreign Relations are all working as a function of Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament. Now at this point, what they're effectively doing is taking psychology, and they're taking religion, they're taking effective use of persuasive speech, and they're wrapping it all together, and the same people who were funding Tavistock were funding the Bolshevik Revolution. They were funding Hitler. They were bankrolling FDR and America's involvement, not only in World War II, but they had already bankrolled America's involvement in World War I, getting Colonel House and Woodrow Wilson into it, creating the Federal Reserve, and taking control of America through externalizing its true ruling power, which is, according to the Constitution, supposed to be held in the Congress as far as printing money. Now, that all might sound like a lot of information to take in, but at the end of the day, what that great conversation builds up to is today's consumer society, the planned obsolescence of America through the creation of temporarily useful goods that create more garbage than they ever provided use. There's no reason that we have to make products or computers or whatever that last 6 months or a year and then you have to buy a new one. That is purposely being done as a function of the design to create extra pollution, to tell people that you are the problem, that you need to fix it, and that the corporations that are doing this have no responsibility. Of course they don't. They're acting and they're programmed as sociopaths. Now, there are solutions. There's an ex-attorney from Skadden Arps, which is a notoriously huge and nefarious law firm, and he worked there for 23 years, and then they discovered that the lawyers are actually causing the problems because it's in the corporate law that's the mandate that they have to go and externalize their costs and go after profit. So he said by adding these 26 words, and I think he's even got it boiled down further, but the point is that you can add these words that say your job is to profit as a corporation, but not at the cost of the environment or human suffering or, you know, it's not about being against profit. It's about responsible profit. It's about compassionate and constructive and conscientious forms of capitalism as opposed to a cartel form of capitalism that goes to extremes and externalizes their costs to third parties in the form of dioxins and pollution and all sorts of diseases and all these things that we see in our society. There is too much pollution going on. What is at the root cause of it? The extreme actions of corporations chasing profit, thinking that no one's ever going to know that they're responsible for these things. So the point is, by changing corporate law, you can make a big improvement. It doesn't fix the whole problem, but it takes out one of the main root causes, which is these corporations externalizing all their costs in the form of pollution and diseases and dioxins and all these other things that are poisoning our food supply as well as our bodies. That was kind of the brilliant thing that they had going on. They're thinking, not only can we externalize the cost of the people, but we can use public relations and propaganda effectively to make people think that they're to blame for it, so that they'll take on all the burden and do all the work necessary to clean up the irresponsible creations of these sociopathic and psychopathic corporations. And that fits right in with their MO. That's exactly what they do. They do something, and then they convince you it was your fault, so you'll pay to clean it up. And that's the same thing, I mean, whether you're talking the bailouts recently or the bailouts in 1908, I mean, this is all the same thing. People have been fooled over and over and over again. The demanding to audit the Fed is a great idea. But if you end up with a gold or a precious metal-based currency afterwards, you're no different than the people who cheered in the Federal Reserve in 1913. As long as you have a fiat currency that's owned by foreigners and you're paying out interest to people who aren't citizens of this country and aren't part of the Congress, I mean, we should be paying ourselves interest. The Congress should be printing money. The American people should be paying themselves interest, not a foreign entity. That's where the hole in the system is. That's where the recurring loop starts that everything builds from. 1992, the United Nations had a meeting, and they called it Agenda 21. You can get the book. In here, it's the 1992 version of the New World Order's plan to make an enemy for humanity, and they decided, hey, it's just easier to make humanity the enemy of itself. Say that all of your actions are adding up to climate change, global warming, however you want to say it, but it's man-made. It doesn't have anything to do with the universe, natural cause of things here on Earth. Granted, there is way too much pollution, and they have done that on purpose to make it seem as if this is the only way it could be, that there's overpopulation because this is the only way it could ever be. When in fact, all the things that you have today that are going on that are adverse to human culture were purposely and contrivedly put there to make us think there is no other way. So therefore, whatever the United Nations and whatever the New World Order wants us to do must be the right way. The other 1992 report comes from a group called the Club of Rome, which has nothing to do with the Vatican. And it's much more like NATO or the Council on Foreign Relations or the Bilderberg Group or the Trilateral Group. This Club of Rome printed a book called The First Global Revolution. And in there, it states the Green Agenda, where basically, we need to be able to control people, otherwise we won't be in charge of the world. So here's how we're going to control people, by artificially polluting the land through a process of planned obsolescence. They would bring humanity to see that humanity was its own worst enemy. and not in our lack of critical thinking. The point is, from documents ranging anywhere from 1967 all the way through 1992, you definitely see these different groups of think tanks, working groups, Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Group, Council of Foreign Relations, Club of Rome, all getting together, United Nations, Agenda 21, all getting together and saying, hey, wouldn't it be a good idea if we made humanity its own worst enemy and told everyone that they're responsible to clean up their mess? That's all it is. It's little children acting like, you know, hey, this is how we get away with stuff. We're going to tell parents one thing, and we're going to do this other thing. So they're acting like little kids, and all I'm saying is they wrote it down in their own books. They said that they want to contrive these different processes to control people, and that we should start to read these books before it's too late, before we don't have a chance to read these books anymore. The global carbon tax is a scam because global warming, anthropogenic global warming, as they've presented it, is contrived solely to get your carbon taxes. They want to tax you on the amount of carbon output or your carbon offset or however that works. However the blood and gore trading firm, Google that. However that works, it's not about solving the problems. It's about taxing you. It's a new form of tax. It's going to be enforced globally on everybody. Now, if you wanted to go up to Al Gore and say, hey, look, global warming, I get you. I have a solution for that. The solution is unprohibit hemp, this plant that's been used for 10,000 years. It could totally fix this problem. No more carbon emissions. The things, they suck off CO2, plant it everywhere, right? It's worth its weight in gold. People could literally grow gold. They could solve their food problems, their fuel problems, their clothing problems, fiber problems, building products, all this stuff. Fire retardant building products, houses that don't burn down. That's a great idea, right? So all of this is right there. If you presented that to Al Gore and said, here's the solution, unprohibit this one plant, do you think he would solve the global warming crisis? No, because his goal is to tax you. He doesn't care about global warming. It's his tax scheme. It's like Bernie Madoff on steroids. That's the same thing with the U.S. economy. We had regulations like Glass-Steagall in there to prevent, through regulation, all of these financial services going out of balance. When they removed, when they repealed Glass-Steagall, when Robert Rubin and his friends repealed Glass-Steagall and removed these regulations, it caused a financial calamity in the form of Tyco and Enron and Anderson Consulting and all these other companies with accounting problems. The Congress then saw fit to fix that through something called Sarbanes-Oxley. Now, the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations were there to be a watchdog to ensure that data could not be deleted from any of these financial services companies, and that would ensure that the auditing all added up and that all these things were in balance and that the economy stayed steady. I went to work at a company that sold the Sarbanes-Oxley compliance software that these companies were mandated to purchase. And when I found out that there was a backdoor in that software, I went to the SEC because I thought, as the Securities and Exchange Commission, they were supposed to watch over the integrity of the markets. When the SEC understood that there were backdoors in the software, and they said, I shouldn't tell anybody about this, I found that hard to believe. When they later bought that software to use the backdoors for themselves so they could delete data and run a corrupt market, I found that to be unconscionable. Because you're talking about the Securities and Exchange Commission that's supposed to watch over the integrity of our fiscal markets in America, and that goes on. This past October 16th, the SEC named a 29-year-old from Goldman Sachs' Business Intelligence Unit as the new SEC Enforcement Division's Chief Operating Officer. The first Chief Operating Officer of an Enforcement Division for the SEC is a 29-year-old kid that comes from Goldman Sachs. Now I ask you, what do you think the integrity and the state of your economy is here in America right now? Because I don't have a lot of confidence in it knowing what I know. The reason I know all of this is because at my job, I saw things that were against the law, that were breaking the law, were putting our financial markets in jeopardy. I then became a whistleblower under the protection of the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations, for which I was selling the compliance software to all the largest financial institutions in America. So seeing these events, blowing the whistle, going to court, presenting your evidence, audio tapes on the record, impeaching their witnesses, laying this all out, it's all going on. It's proven in court. Nothing happens. You go to every press outlet you can find. Nobody wants to print it. I got Lowell Bergman from Frontline to work on my case for a year and a half. Still didn't get printed. effectively all they do is take up your time and never put it out to the public. Because if the public knew what I knew 3-4 years ago, they could have prevented being taken advantage of by Bernie Madoff and Robert Rubin and Tim Geithner and Larry Summers and all these other characters. Mm-hmm. All these other clowns have been taking advantage of America because the Fourth Estate, the media, the news that is supposed to be out there, that you're paying for $50 a month for your New York Times or $75, $90 a month for your Wall Street Journal, they're not telling you the truth, and you're still paying them. I think it's insane to give your money continuously to sources that are paid to lie to you. They're making profits from suppressing the information. All great religious and educational institutions do two things. They provide you information, they reveal it, and they conceal it. They conceal just as much as they reveal, and that which they conceal is so much more valuable than anything they reveal. So in other words, you're getting cheated on your college education, you're getting cheated on your master's education, you're getting cheated on your PhD education. All of these pieces of education are there in absentia. The difference between a slave and a prisoner is that the prisoner knows that there's freedom just on the other side of the wall, and that getting the freedom is a finite set of steps. The slave doesn't understand that there's freedom out there. The slave thinks this is all there is, there's nothing I can do about it, and all I can ever hope for is kind of a better master. Someone who's just, you know, I'm still a slave, I'm completely dependent, they will provide me with what I need and tell me what I need to do. I just hope that maybe they have a better protocol, right? So the slave mentality is waiting for, well, a better protocol to tell them what to do. And the prisoner mentality is free thinking and trying to figure out, I'm in a box, they've put me in this confined area, how do I break out of here? How do I get over this proverbial wall? The idea is that through sharing information and communicating through a fact-based, reliable media that's verifiable and has integrity, that you can offer people this rope that allows them to climb over the wall. It's like, we're not trying to break everybody out, but we're just saying, if you understand that there is freedom out there and you are looking for the rope to climb over the wall, don't look at it as a threat when we're throwing the rope over the wall and trying to say, hey, look, here's a little information. The identification of the problem is that, you know, there's any number of leaves on a tree, but the root of the problem is the suppression of consciousness. Everything that goes on out there is about the suppression of consciousness. It's the only war that's ever gone on. It's the war that keeps mankind from knowing its own mind. It's those veils and illusions that are put, those boundaries, those artificial partitions that say, do not go beyond here. And at the end of the day, Einstein once said that you can't solve a problem in the same mindset that created it. It means you have to expand your awareness. It means if you don't have the solutions in front of you, then the solution must be out here, and you're going to have to expand your awareness to get to where that solution is. So this is all about adding to what we know, verifying what we know, questioning what we know, questioning what we believe, and getting down to things that we can communicate back and forth and accept as mutually agreeable facts. Every piece of film is a piece of propaganda, and what you have to learn to discern for yourself, is it here to help you express your consciousness, or are we trying to suppress your consciousness? I hope if you learned anything, you learned to think.